Hi, and welcome to Popaholics, the show where a dad and daughter dish on pop culture. I'm Steve Hall.
I'm Kate Hall.
Kate, the 99th episode.
is now. We're recording it now.
And Mike Bodie made some new bumpers. We're going to use those today. We just got a thing saying we had, 102 downloads last week?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Which continues to blow both of our minds. Because we've talked about how I'm like, oh, this is just a fun thing that I do with my dad to, you know, to connect. And like, I was going to say the badass word, shoot the bat. But since I'm not allowed to. You know, just to like be silly and hang with each other, and then once it's done, once we're done recording, you take the reins, and then besides like trying to keep up with posting the weekly stuff on Instagram, I like don't think about it. It's wild. Thank you to whoever.
Yeah, thank you to everyone who has downloaded the show, and you know, please. You know, follow us on all the social media. And as Andrew Hickey says on 500, the history of rock and roll and 500 songs, if you enjoy this, please tell just one person, because word of mouth is the way that creative endeavors become popular. I couldn't do the Manchester accent, but that's what he says. So yes, please tell people about the show, and we will continue to provide content that's hopefully you enjoy. First off, Kate and I are going to talk about something we have both seen, The Diplomat on Netflix. You want me to start and then you respond?
Well, I can give the summary.
Okay, you give the summary.
Because I know you have notes. From Netflix's little blurb thing when you start the series, The Diplomat is about, after a hostile attack on a British vessel, seasoned American diplomat Kate Wyler, played by Keri Russell, assumes a new role in the UK that puts her skills and her marriage to the test. And so, in addition to Keri Russell, Rufus Sewell, David Gyasi, I Googled the pronunciation and I hope I got it right, and Rory Kinnear also star. And my first note, Dad, before you get started, is Rufus Sewell, I think it's just his face. He looks like you don't want to mess with him. He looks kind of, you know, a little scary. And so I feel like he always gets typecast into kind of anti-hero or villain roles, which I'm sure that's much more fun than playing like the good guy all the time. But I really enjoyed his character in this series, even though if I were married to him, as Keri Russell's character is married to him in series, I would also be very, very frustrated and annoyed and at the point of divorcing him.
So to what I wrote about that, first of all, I said this was an intelligent, dialogue-driven drama that mixes political intrigue with sexy relationship matters. As she said, they're Kate and Hal Wyler. They're career diplomats. They're both very good at what they do, but Hal often uses his charm, bends the rules to make things happen, and then the people who help him inevitably wish they hadn't. Mm-hmm. So yes, they have this, their marriage is in trouble. She's ready for a divorce. He's not. Then they had this attack on the British ship. She was expected to be posted to Kabul, and all of a sudden, President names her ambassador to the United Kingdom, and she can't figure out what's going on. She wants to be in the thick of things. But one of the things that's going on, unbeknownst to her, is she's being vetted to possibly be the vice president. Hal, the Rufus Sewell character, is kind of having problems adjusting to playing second fiddle to her, and he goes about and creating mischief a lot. So I said the writing's very smart. I thought the cast was great up and down the line. I wrote, playing a couple with a turbulent marriage, Russell and Sewell have the love-hate relationship and sexual chemistry you wish Julia Roberts and George Clooney had in Ticket to Paradise.
Oh, I didn't watch it. But yeah. I can assume I know how that's going to go. It was funny, and I guess you could say I do like political thrillers, but I'm not because I am frustrated by the way quote unquote politics works across the world, then I kind of tend to like tune that out a little bit. But with this, it didn't feel like it was too in the weeds. And when they get into the politics, it's, you're like trying to figure out what's going on. They think it's this country that attacked the British vessel, but actually that doesn't make sense because all this other stuff is happening.
Right.
So what better way than, you know, another country to kind of like pin the blame on them? Oh, but wait, maybe it's not even right. This.
I think one reason that it works pretty well is because of that. It mixes that political intrigue with the sexy relationship stuff. I wrote, think of The West Wing meets Shonda Rhimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You keep bringing up the sexy relationship, and that wasn't the biggest deal to me. I liked their back and forth, and I didn't really care that much about the sexy parts of it.
I will warn people, Rufus is not shy about dropping trowel in this one. So,
yeah.
Well, let me mention something else that Kerry Russell is in. Totally different side of the artistic spectrum. And this is Cocaine Bear on Peacock. This is your basic monster movie horror comedy with the monster, a massive black bear who ingests a lot of lost cocaine and then goes on a killing rampage. So it's every bit as cheesy as it sounds. There are good people in this cast. Kerry Russell plays a mom whose daughter is in jeopardy, you know, by the bear. Yeah. The late Ray Liotta, I can't say his name. You know,
Ray Liotta.
Yes. Plays a drug dealer. Margot Martindale, who, you know, people would go, oh, I've seen her in a zillion things. She plays a park ranger. And there's even Jesse Tyler Ferguson from Modern Family as a tree hugger type nature lover. Way too many characters for us to invest seriously in any of them. I was thinking about how the movie Jaws, it's really about three guys and a shark. Okay. This has like 12 or 13 characters in the bear. You can't see the story for the crowd, so to speak. And then the script by Jimmy Warden is also pretty lame. But here's the thing. Have you seen this movie, Kate?
I was going to say, you know, this is based on a true story, right?
It's based on a true story. Yeah.
Okay.
A bear did eat cocaine, but then he didn't go around, you know, killing people like this bear does, or jumping into the back of speeding ambulances to kill people. I would say that director Elizabeth Banks, who we also know as an actress, knows this is a ridiculous premise. And when she embraces the ridiculousness, when showing the bear's over the top attacks, the movie really comes to life and it's kind of fun. So is Cocaine Bear cheesy and ridiculous? Hey, does a bear sniff blow in the woods? Thank you.
Yeah, I only know about Cocaine Bear because it was my favorite murder episode. And it is just one of those like weird, bizarre things that happens. And so like, sure, at least they didn't make another, you know, like Saw 25 or whatever number they're on. You know what I mean?
It's kind of like this year's Snakes on a Plane, I would say.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this book that I have to talk about takes a pretty serious turn than what we've been talking about so far. So I recently read a short novel called Quantum Girl Theory by Erin Kate Ryan. Last time I said I had forgot my notes. The reason why is because I was like, how do I explain this? So from the book jacket, I'm going to quote, part deceptive novel, part ghost story. This brilliant debut asks a tantalizing question. What really happens when a girl goes missing? So this book actually was inspired by a real missing persons case, which happened in the, I believe, late 40s in, where's Bennington? Is that Massachusetts?
Is it Vermont? Bennington, Vermont?
Maybe it's Vermont. So back then, a student at Bennington College, Paula Jean Weldon, she got out of classes for the day. She told her roommate and people that she saw on campus that she was going to go for a hike and then disappeared. They never found her body. But a bunch of people saw her because she was wearing a very distinct red parka and like tennis shoes. So a bunch of people saw her along the way where she was going to, but then nobody ever found her. They never found her body, all that stuff. So then, of course, because she was a young white woman, she came from a wealthy family, the case got a ton of attention. Even like the search went down even into the southern United States because people had thought that they had seen her or noticed the parka, the red parka. Oh, it's got to be her, la, 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 la. This book kind of explores the main character who goes by, she's assumed a different name. So Paula Jean is living as somebody else now, and she's on the run, but she's also kind of working as a medium for other missing girls. Stay with me on this because it's a little windy. So she's in, I think, Mississippi or Georgia or something, and someone approaches her to help have her help them find two missing Black girls. And then another family asked for her help to find a missing white girl. And so, you know, this is several years later, like 50s, early 60s in the South, in the United States. And so she's coming up against all this stuff. Like, obviously the family, the white family, is getting more help from the white sheriff than the Black families in town are. They're getting nothing. Nobody is helping them. It's bringing up a lot of stuff from her past. Why did she run away? Did she run away? Was she like
abducted?
Was she, what's the word when your family throws you out?
Disowned.
That's what I'm looking for. Thanks, Dad. Was she disowned by her parents? So why was that? And so then it starts to take on kind of a weird Twilight Zone tone to it. But it was a very fast read, and I really enjoyed it, mostly because it does make you think about, you know, we all know, especially with the recent case of, you know, Gabby Petito, who was a young white woman that was murdered by her fiance, and how quickly that whole situation got solved versus, you know, I don't even know what the count is up to now, unfortunately, with like the hundreds of cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women, of Black women who, quote unquote, disappear and are never found. And so I thought it was a really interesting way to explore that. So
the name of that book again was?
The book is Quantum Girl Theory by Erin Kate Ryan.
So I'm going to talk about something else streaming. This was also based on a true story. It's a movie called On a Wing and a Prayer. It's on Prime. I went into this 2023 survival movie starring Dennis Quaid and Heather Graham with high hopes. I knew it was based on a real 2009 incident in which the pilot of a small aircraft died mid-flight. And so a passenger had to fly and land the plane with just the instructions of these people, you know, in his headset that were at these two other airports, and then a flight instructor in Connecticut. This is taking place in like Florida and Louisiana, but then this guy in Connecticut also got involved. So it's kind of crazy. It sounded like a great setup for some nail-biting thrills. Well, Dennis Quaid, looking more and more like a weathered Harrison Ford these days, and then Heather Graham, they play two pharmacists who are married. They are committed Christians with two daughters. Hence the prayer in the title. Be prepared. There is some God stuff here in this movie. The movie begins with an unintentionally funny scene where Quaid's Doug is botching a flying lesson and he's sweating profusely, which really reminded me of Robert Hayes in Airplane, if you've ever seen that movie where the sweat's pouring off of him. So when Doug's brother dies suddenly in Florida, Doug and his family, you know, they go there to the funeral, and then they end up taking the small charter flight back home to Louisiana on Easter Sunday. Once the pilot has a heart attack, Doug has to try and fly and land the plane. He doesn't know anything about the plane, and there's an ominous storm approaching. Okay, well, if this sounds promising, think again. Director Sean McNamara maintains a sluggish sluggish pace, which isn't helped by all the time the movie devotes to the backstories of the people who helped Doug. Okay. They all have, air quotes, issues, end air quotes. There are even scenes with two airplane obsessed kids. And so my wife and I are watching this and we're thinking, oh, these kids must play some vital role in him, you know, landing the plane. No, their sole purpose is to be exposition, explaining what's happening to us, the audience, right? Okay. I often yelled at the screen or laughed at the ridiculousness of what were supposed to be dramatic moments. On a Wing and a Prayer, Kate, never really takes off.
You're full of little quips today, bud. Yeah. I mean, I'm honestly surprised that you watched it, because neither of us like air travel, I would say, in any capacity. And so I don't want to watch something that's going to make me even more nervous when I get on a plane.
But you know, I think
even though the point is that he landed the plane,
You know what I mean? But I think one of the things that one reason I watch it is because Dennis Quaid, I liked a bunch of his movies. Heather Graham, I like Heather Graham. You know, so then it was just discouraging to see him in this thing. So,
well, you got to pay the bill.
So. That's right. And actors have Dennis mortgages Quaid, too.
Even Dennis Quaid has to pay the bills. My book to talk about is called Be Not Afraid of Love, Lessons on Fear, Intimacy, and Connection by Mimi Zhu. I'm so sorry. Be Not Afraid of Love explores the intersection of love and fear and self-esteem, friendship, family dynamics, and romantic relationships, and extends out to its effects on society and the greater political realm. This had popped up on some list, which we all know that I like my lists on recommendations for books, especially. Basically, the author, whose pronouns are they, them, the author survived an intimate partner abuse, like horrific abuse. And so on their healing journey, through their healing journey, decided to write a book about how much that relationship had affected them. And also, once they were, you know, recovering and going to therapy and exploring traditional Chinese medicine, you know, all of these things to help them heal and become, I don't want to say become a better person, but to become maybe whole again, or as whole again as a person can be. Of course, they were making all these connections of like, oh, part of this dynamic in this relationship that caused me so much harm actually is replicated in the person who hurt me and their relationships with their parents and my parents and our relationship, and even my relationship with my job and capitalism and all of that stuff. And so I'm not quite done with it. I think I've got a couple chapters left, but I found it, this collection of essays, really helpful and not preachy. If you are a person that, you know, struggles with not intimate partner abuse, because thankfully, very, very luckily, I've never had to go through that, and I hope I never will, but you never know. But if you are a person who is concerned about the world that we live in, I think this is an interesting jumping off point or a further exploration of how all of this is kind of twisted together in such a huge mess that we're all kind of responsible of getting ourselves out of. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does.
So Dad's got a very serious thinking face on. And so I was very hesitant, even though I did want to read it. It took me a while to get into it, just because I appreciate a person's honesty and what they've been through. But even just reading about about that happening to someone is really hard. No, I do think that, you know, that we need to witness it.
Okay. So the title again was?
It's Be Not Afraid of Love by Mimi Zhu, I think is how you say it. Okay.
We have gotten the time warning, so I'm going to sneak a book in here real quick. Okay. What Moves the Dead by T. Kingfisher. This is a gripping, atmospheric retelling of Edgar Allan Poe's short story, The Fall of the House of Usher. If you remember that story, it practically defines Gothic horror as we think of it, with themes of isolation, a crumbling mansion, madness, strange family relationships. In this updating, Easton, who is a non-binary retired soldier, goes to visit their friend, Roderick Usher, and sister Madeline, because they had heard Madeline is seriously ill. Even so, Easton is shocked at what they find. Madeline is practically a corpse, sleepwalking, talking in a strange voice at night. Can Easton get to the bottom of what's going on in time with the help of an American doctor who's also visiting the Ushers and a no-nonsense English woman studying the fungi nearby? The book is creepy and imaginative. I couldn't put it down and flew through it in 2 days. Highly recommended. What Moves the Dead by T. Kingfisher. Quick, you got about 7 minutes to talk about the Met Gala. Go.
Oh, it won't take me that long. Okay, so the Met Gala, the theme this year was basically honoring Karl Lagerfeld, who passed away in 2019. He was the creative director of Chanel for, I think, almost 40 years, which is wild. And so, and of course, even the most fashion ignorant, I guess we'll say, know basically the vibe of Chanel. Every year the Met Institute puts on this gala. It is a ticketed event, and all of that, those proceeds go towards the Met and the collections and, you know, all of that stuff. The themes in past years have been kind of wild. There was a year of camp. There was, I think they had two Mets during the pandemic that were about American fashion. And so generally the looks are either very, very hit or very, very miss. And we've talked about a couple of them.
Very weird.
Very weird, which is, that's fine. That's part of, you know, what fashion is, art. So this year, I was like, okay, Karl Lagerfeld, Chanel, I'm excited to see what people are going to do. I was going to say, you can't mess it up, but you also, like Dad said, can make it weird. Chanel is like, and Karl Lagerfeld is like, black and white, tweed, the camellia flower, which is Chanel's signature flower, little pops of color, some pinks, some reds. It can be a little rock and roll. It can be a little grandma chic, preppy chic. So I was like, okay, what are they going to do? Tons of models and actresses showed up in vintage Chanel, which I thought was the great. Dua Lipa wore a Chanel wedding dress, vintage Chanel wedding dress that I believe Claudia Schiffer wore originally on the runway. Gorgeous, beautiful, loved it. Cardi B, I can't remember what the designer was, but Cardi B showed up in a dress that was like the camellia flowers, but in black. And she always looks great at the Met Gala. Taking it in another direction, kind of similarly inspired looks, Doja Cat.
Yeah, that was a great dress. Go ahead.
So she had that beautiful dress, and then her makeup in the like headpiece to the dress was inspired by a Choupette, who was Karl Lagerfeld's cat. And so her face makeup made her look like a cat.
And she had small ears.
Yeah, a little like a kitten ear headpiece thing. And so then, Dad, this morning, I saw an interview from the red carpet. They had Emma Chamberlain, who's an influencer, interviewing other celebrities on the red carpet. So she interviewed Doja Cat, and kudos to her for going along with it, because I would just be like in tears laughing. I couldn't do it. She's asking really good, you know, fashion questions, and Doja Cat is only responding in meows. So Doja Cat commits to the bit, and I love it. She's a performer through and through.
And then didn't Jared Leto in one of his outfits?
Here is the other thing. Jared Leto showed
weird,
up
in, weird guy.
In like a furry cat suit, like with a almost like of a mascot head of a very realistic looking cat head. He tends to go a little weird because people let him, because he's objectively a beautiful man. But that looked really,
it was crazy.
It bothered me. Like, let's not do that. We can do Doja Cat because I think that is more artistic and not cheap and playful. It's not creepy. Whereas Jared Leto, I think, is just baseline creepy. So,
his second outfit was this black outfit. It kind of reminded me of John Wick meets a wizard. But he looked good in it, you know. Well, what can you say?
Yeah, I'm not sure who he wore. It was might have been Gucci because I think he has a brand
partnership. Yeah.
But yeah, it's. I would say overall, I think this was the easiest theme for a lot of celebrities and their stylists in the past few years. And I'm still kind of looking at all the looks as the pictures are rolling in. But I did want to talk about the Doja Cat versus Jared Leto.
Well, and we'll have links that show some of these photos. I have to say, when I saw the Doja Cat and then the Jared Leto thing, I was like, did this designer have the white Persian like Blofeld and James Bond?
Maybe, who knows? One other look that I really liked is, you know, it's Derby Week in Kentucky. People are proud. People are repping. And Jack Harlow, who's a Kentucky boy, he's a rapper. He was at the Met Gala. And at first I was like, is he wearing denim on denim? And then I you know, zoomed in. He was wearing like navy tweed, which is classic Chanel. Jack Harlow is not really my style, but I was impressed with the look. Yeah.
Cool. Well, we are actually out of time. So tune in next time for our 100th episode. It's going to be fantastic. Some looks back, I think, if I can get the things edited. For Popaholics, I'm Steve Hall.
I'm Kate Hall.
Go out and enjoy pop culture.
Bye.